Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3138, United States of America versus Khalid Muhammad Shaban, appellant. Ms. Rowland for the appellant, Ms. Scruggs for the appellee.
May it please the court, my name is Sandra Rowland, representing Mr. Khalid Shaban. On the question of the sufficiency of the evidence, appellant's burden is quite high to win. He has to show that a reasonable doubt is compelled. On the other hand, as to the question of whether he should is entitled to a hearing in the district court, appellant's burden is minimal and the government's burden is quite high.
Before you get into the merits, I'd like to ask a couple of questions. Is he still in prison?
No. He served 3 years, his three-year term. He is on supervised release.
Yeah. And why has this taken so long to reach us?
Mr. Shaban was aware that the time was running and that he would likely serve his term of incarceration if we kept delaying, and yet he had concerns that required us to work together for quite a while and ask for extensions. His concern was and remains having his conviction ultimately vacated, and he was not so concerned about whether he was going to finish his term of...
At least it wasn't the court dropped it.
Absolutely not, no. It was all defense motions to for extensions. If appellant has made a colorable claim that his counsel was ineffective, he's entitled to a hearing on that issue. A colorable claim is the lowest standard that we have, and it's been defined as one that is not wholly frivolous. His claims regarding his counsel's failure to present a defense are not wholly frivolous. He needed to create a reasonable doubt about whether he acted with the specific intent to deny, to obstruct Ms. Hernandez's parental rights. And the evidence and testimony that he proposed to his attorney was relevant to his intent.
Can I ask what's the thinking behind raising a claim like this just generally? On direct rather than in 2255, on direct appeal?
Well, and this court's cases in most recently in Rashad, that was the procedure that was approved.
That's permissible, I understand that. But what's the advantage to that from the defendant's perspective?
I think from the defendant's perspective, the more attenuated you get, the further you get from your trial, it gets statistically less and less likely that you're going to succeed.
The problem is, if you raise it on direct appeal, you may never, it may get shut down at the outset rather than in a 2255, at least you get into the district court.
Right, but when you're looking at a colorable claim, a claim that's not wholly frivolous, and particularly here where you're looking at, the statute requires specific intent.
Is that the same standard the district court would be applying?
No.
If it were raised directly in the district court? If it were 2255 in the district court without having been raised on direct?
No. The district court would just be applying the Strickland standard.
Right.
So what we're doing is asking this court to allow the district court to apply the Strickland standard.
That's why I don't understand the strategy of raising something like this on direct appeal rather than raising it in a 2255 if you really want to get a district court hearing.
We can do it in either way. I'm not really sure, whether in particular cases it's more advantageous to do it this way or that way.
Well, you avoid a problem of having later successive habeas, right? I mean, in case
you preserve your entitlement to a 2255 on some other issue. Whether it's advantageous or not, we certainly don't see it as disadvantageous because it's
obviously that's the
it's
case
so
because
easy.
It's raised constantly on direct appeal, and I was just curious about the
right.
thinking on that because it wasn't clear to me that that's really advantageous. But.
Right. Well, really, given particularly in this case, given the very, very minimal standard that we have to meet and the claims that he's raised that go directly to the very only, you know, the sole issue in the case, which was his intent.
Doesn't your whole argument about the counsel's possible failings turn on a notion of intent, which is questionable? That is to say, you read intent as a desire to achieve a particular result, whereas in most cases, intent is satisfied by showing the commission of acts under circumstances where it's perfectly obvious that the particular consequence will flow, even though they may be, from the point of view of the actor, they may be only side effects.
Congress chose to make this a specific intent crime.
I just noticed in your brief you say specific intent, and then you quote the statute which says with intent. But there are lots of statutes that say that, and I don't think they're normally construed as requiring, as I say, a desire to achieve this particular result as opposed to acting for other purposes with the obvious consequence of achieving that using that result.
If this were a general intent offense, I think it would say, it would use words like knowingly and intentionally.
But you didn't object to, there was no objection, I should say, to the jury instruction. And the jury instruction says you may infer that a person intended the natural and probable consequences of acts knowingly done.
Correct. There was no objection to that, and
wasn't that,
and that
the key
is,
to the, it wasn't that instruction really the key to the.
Yes, it was, and that is perhaps a failing that would go to our first issue on sufficiency of the evidence, as to whether counsel was ineffective in failing to put forward a defense and bring up evidence that would have undermined the intent element.
Counsel have tried to object to that instruction or to get a different instruction?
I think so, yes. But the fact that he didn't isn't related to whether Mr. Chabon has made a colorable claim and should get a hearing. I mean, perhaps I should have raised that as another example of ineffectiveness, but it certainly doesn't undermine his claim for a hearing.
I'm not so sure of that, because if the record comes to us under circumstances where we must assume the correctness of that charge, then that would seem to frame the way in which we assess his failure to produce the evidence you think he should have produced. And with that instruction, with that view of the law, it's hard for me to see how the extra evidence could have made much difference. It would paint him in a more sympathetic light, undoubtedly.
The view of the law, from our perspective, is that it is a specific intent offense, and we have raised that. We have made that argument. I don't think that this court can say, well, perhaps it is a specific intent offense, but the jury wasn't so instructed, and therefore evidence that would have undermined his specific intent, you haven't made a colorable claim that evidence would have, the failure to put that evidence in was ineffective.
Well, this is on your ineffective assistance claim. On the sufficiency claim,
yes.
We have to take the instructions as correct, given that there's no challenge to those.
I think on the sufficiency claim,
unless it's plain error.
I think on the sufficiency claim, this court needs to determine the elements of the offense. I mean, we've raised a sufficiency saying it's a specific intent offense, and a reasonable doubt was compelled under these circumstances. So, whatever the jury's instruction, I think this court has to reach that question of the elements.
A necessary component of what you just said is that the jury instruction's wrong.
Do you think the jury instruction's wrong? What's wrong? I'm not following. What do you think is wrong with the jury instruction?
I think that the jury instruction really defines a general intent.
Didn't it say you have to find intent to obstruct the lawful exercise of parental rights?
Yes.
And that is what the statute says.
I think it's the last
sentence.
That says...
But you can infer, this is just an evidentiary rule. You can infer intent, including specific intent from
absolutely.
Actions.
Absolutely. I think that the part that's wrong, I'm looking at the government's brief because they quoted it. On page 12 and 13, let's see.
Last sentence of the first paragraph, the first full paragraph of the instruction there. You may infer, I think that's the sentence that you have a problem with or should have a problem with.
Right, you may infer but are not required to that a person intended the natural and probable consequences of acts knowingly done or omitted. I think that defines a general intent offense.
Yes, but even in a specific intent offense, there's two different things that have to be proven. One is that intended the acts to occur, and second, the specific intent. And the next paragraph of the charge, it says, in this case, to find him guilty, you must determine beyond a reasonable doubt he intended to obstruct the lawful exercise of parental rights. That is the specific intent you're talking about, right?
Yes, that is the specific intent.
Right. So I don't really see, I mean, you obviously haven't objected. Frankly, I don't see how you could object to this instruction. But what I'm not seeing is how, I took your opening to suggest that there really isn't much to be done here with respect to sufficiency of the evidence and that you're putting most of your argument into ineffectiveness. Is that fair?
It's fair to say that I think the burden is very high right. on the sufficiency and very low on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Right. So what's the colorable claim with respect to prejudice that is for ineffectiveness? How do we get to that?
Okay. Well, I would like to answer your question, but I would also like to argue that that's not the standard, that we don't have to show...
You don't think you have to show a colorable claim of prejudice for ineffectiveness?
We have to show a colorable claim of ineffective assistance.
Yes.
And then the government, a remand is required unless the government can conclusively show that he could not show prejudice even if given a chance. So I don't think it's that we're showing a colorable claim that the performance fell below the standard and a colorable claim that it was prejudicial, but we're showing a colorable claim that it was below the standard of the professional standard, and the government then has to come back and argue that
prejudice conclusive?
That the record as it stands now conclusively shows that he will not be able to demonstrate prejudice. And that they cannot do that here.
But isn't that this, what's the difference? If you've shown a colorable claim, then they can't show, conclusive means you don't have a colorable claim. So are these really two different kinds of arguments that you're making? Isn't it really the same? If you have a colorable claim.
A colorable claim is one that's not entirely frivolous. Mm-hmm. That's a very low standard. Showing conclusively that you know, under no circumstances can you show that this prejudiced you seems like, to me, a very high standard.
High standard for the government. But
high standard
so that
for
would
the government.
Mean that you didn't even have a colorable claim. If they could show conclusively, then you wouldn't have even a colorable claim. So aren't those just two sides of the same?
Well, not necessarily. If we showed that, he didn't investigate, he didn't put forth documentary and testimonial evidence, and they came back and said, yes, we agree that, you know, he didn't do that, but no amount of defense evidence could have changed the outcome, you know, that it's conclusively shown that there was no amount of evidence would have helped you.
I understand. The distinction you're making, is this all coming from Rashad, what you're saying?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I think here, for the court to say that the government has conclusively shown that there was no prejudice, it would in effect, be saying that no mountain of defense evidence as to a different intent in this case, his intent to help his child.
No mountain, given what he's already said and what the evidence already is.
No mountain could ever create a reasonable doubt. Uh-huh. There cannot be a reasonable doubt.
Well, no, but it's not no mountain. It's no mountain as defined by the examples that you're suggesting you have. It's not any evidence that there might be in the world. There's any evidence that you're saying the lawyer knew about and didn't develop,
true.
Right? So what
it's
evidence?
It's a pretty extensive list.
It's extensive, but much of it doesn't really go to intent, I don't think. So tell me what is the strongest piece of evidence that shows that he did not have the specific intent?
Well,
that's the strongest piece of evidence that wasn't put in that shows
right,
that.
Right. I don't want to evade the question, but it is very hard to pinpoint one thing because it is cumulative, mm-hmm. and there are. Some claims that we can't really even flesh out at this point. For example, Mr. Chabon was never permitted to listen to the tapes in advance of trial. And so at the trial, he heard some of the tapes, the ones that were played, but in advance of trial, he didn't hear those and he didn't hear the others and wasn't able to provide his lawyer context and meaning. And there were many pieces of evidence, such as the inference that when he
said... But by the time we get on appeal like this, we normally ask you've had the right to hear the tapes if you want to point out to something that might have been admitted into trial that wasn't.
Well...
You can't just say,
Well, that's not true. I could not get the tapes to him. I tried and tried. I mean, he was in a federal prison where they would not allow tapes or CDs to be sent to him. So, no, he never did hear them.
This would suggest that there would be no situation in which we'd ever decide ineffectiveness here, that we would always remand. Under what circumstances would we, and of course that's not what we always do.
I think if there were no factual findings to be made, for example, if it was ineffectiveness claims based on failure to object to instructions or something that was purely legal with no factual claims, then this court could decide it on the trial record. But where, like in Rashad and like here, there are factual claims that this court can't determine, this court can't call witnesses, and then the court has to remand the case to the district court.
Am I right that no other circuit resolves ineffective assistance claims on direct appeal like this, right? In the first instance?
I don't know.
Pretty sure that's right.
I'd be happy to look into it and write a brief on it.
It wouldn't matter. We have a rule in the circuit, so this panel can't overturn the rule anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Can you tell me, though, what you think the strongest evidence is?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I forgot about that.
I know.
I think perhaps some of the... To counter the evidence that the government had used to show consciousness of guilt or, perhaps uncooperativeness, for example, when the evidence that the former babysitter went to Egypt and the government presented evidence that Mr. Chabon did not deliver the child on time to the airport. Mr. Chabon disputes that. He says that he did deliver the child on time and it was the nanny's fault that the child was not able to get on the plane. There was, and the government relied on that. They put on testimony, they talked about it in closing argument. Evidence about how his various names on documents, the government argued that that was consciousness of guilt, that he had sometimes he's Khaled Chabon, sometimes he's Chabon Khaled. Evidence about Arabic names and westernizing those names would have undermined their inference of a consciousness of guilt. I'm trying to think of, a cross-examination of the roommate on the inconsistency in his testimony about...
I was unclear about what you could get out of that, other than that Shaban's story was inconsistent. What?
Well, Mr. Shaban disputes the roommate's testimony. He says he didn't call the man and say, stay out of the apartment.
I understand that, but how does cross-examination get to that point? And if Shaban doesn't so testify, how does cross-examination get to that?
Well, assuming the truth of Mr. Shaban's claim that it would jog the witness's memory,
the Perry and Mason moment, isn't it true that you're a liar and the guy says, yes, I'm a liar, you got me?
Well, why do we ever allow cross-examination? I mean, hopefully it brings out the truth, it jogs a person's
memory. No, I got
memory.
All that, I'm sure having done trials yourself that there are some times when you decide that cross-examination is not the best thing for your client.
Yes.
And so it can't be that every time that there's a choice made not to cross-examine that it's ineffective. You'd have to give some reason.
No, of course it isn't. I guess what I'm doing now is trying to point to some of his claims are things that just did not come up at all at trial, like the fact that he enrolled his child in speech therapy and the child's testing and deficiencies and his progress. But in terms of, what's my best claim, I think perhaps the things that directly rebutted evidence that the government relied on. So that is the roommate's testimony, I'm sorry, I'm losing my train of thought here.
All right, you've given me two now. So with respect to the specific intent, do you disagree with the point that you can have more than one intent here, that his intent could be to help his child, but at the same time his intent could be to intentionally obstruct parental rights? Is it not possible to have both?
I think it is possible to have more than one intent, mm-hmm. Yes. And the government's burden here was to prove, just one. The specific intent to obstruct her.
Well, that even if he had both, even if he intended to obstruct, but did that for the purpose of helping his child, he'd still be guilty. Then.
As long as he intended to
obstruct.
Obstruct.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Emily Scruggs on behalf of the United States, here with my deputy chief, Elizabeth Trostman, and trial counsel below, Angela Schmidt. First, focusing on an effective assistance claim that's been raised by appellant. The government would submit that appellant has not made a colorable claim, a deficient performance, or that falling below an objective standard of reasonableness. But even if there was deficient performance here, the government believes the record conclusively shows that there is no reasonable probability that but for any sort of deficient performance, there would have been a different outcome below. That is, the factual record before the court.
Well, you could have argued, I suppose the defense could argue, that this jury instruction defined intent in terms of both wanting the result or alternatively knowing the likelihood of the result. Either of those under the jury instruction satisfied intent, and the defense could argue that for this crime the mens rea instruction should have followed the model penal code purpose, which doesn't have that latter possibility of knowing the probable outcome of or the probable consequences of your actions. In other words, you have to actually want the result, not just to know it's likely to occur under the model penal code 202. And if you argue that, that's maybe a loser in the end, but it would change the outcome potentially, right? If there was a different jury instruction there.
Well, I would say first that was not argued below, as has been discussed earlier, that
no,
instruction
it obviously wasn't argued below because ineffective assistance is being argued for the first time here.
It's not being argued here either, I take it. except in this oral argument.
It was mentioned during oral argument, but it's not in the briefs. And I'd also note that...
Well, it's asserted conclusory form in the brief.
Even taking that language that's in that jury instruction, specific intent, as this is the standard instruction on intent that the judge gave, can be proved through circumstantial evidence. You can't look inside the direct workings of the human mind. And that looking at the circumstantial evidence in the cases the court did instruct, the jury was charged with determining beyond a reasonable doubt that he intended to obstruct the lawful exercise
right,
of parental rights.
The true story from the defendant's point of view of the nanny, the role of the nanny in the attempted send back would be highly relevant on the question of intent as we're now formulating it?
I don't think on the record that we have before us, I think the evidence the government put forth as to the specific intent to obstruct parental rights was substantial. It was far beyond sufficient.
The question is whether the addition of the evidence that the lawyer failed to produce had a reasonable possibility of changing the result.
I don't think that it did.
You're going back to the blue brief's first argument, the insufficiency of evidence.
Well, the reason that I don't think it had a reasonable probability of changing the outcome below is because of the substantial evidence that the government presented as to his intent to deceive Ms. Hernandez.
You're
using the wrong word if you're using the
word
substantial.
Yeah, you really are. You mean overwhelming. I have to say I don't find it the least bit overwhelming on this particular premise about intent.
Well, the evidence that he lied to Ms. Hernandez about taking the child to Egypt when he told her King's Dominion, it's undisputed that he lied to her. And that's when he took the child out of the country.
Well, of course he would lie, right? To achieve his result from his point of view, he pretty much has to, right?
Well, the point is...
I mean, he has to act with some duplicity in order to achieve his purpose, right? Well, his stated, conceded purpose.
Well, his purpose also in lying to her was to obstruct her ability to say, no, I don't want you taking the child out of the country.
That's quite a spin on the intent to obstruct parental rights, I think.
Well, the...
Is it true that it can't be the case that every lie told by splitting parents to each other runs afoul of this statute?
Well, it's when you're lying to another parent with whom you have an agreement.
I understand.
The government's position...
Suppose he just, instead of taking her to King's Dominion, he'd gone to some amusement park that the mother disliked, right? He would have disrupted parental rights.
But he wouldn't have taken her outside the country.
If the amusement park had been in another country. And in this case, I would note that the evidence is strong, that there is a written custodial order which says that they can't take the child out of the country without the written consent of the other parent. To deceive the mother in the manner in which he did, he had to have acted with a specific intent to obstruct her ability to say, no, I don't want you taking that child to Egypt. He may have also acted with the intent that he wanted to help improve the child's language skills, and that evidence came out at trial. That evidence was before the jury. Also before the jury, though, was this substantial and overwhelming evidence that he deceived the mother in doing so. And you can act with more than one intent and still be convicted underneath the statute. And for example, I would point to the exemptions under the statute, one of which allows for parents to take a child out of the country when there's a cycle of domestic violence they're trying to break. That in and of itself shows that the statute allows for you to act with more than one intent. The intent
the government agrees that this is a specific intent crime, I take it?
Yes. This is a specific intent crime.
What that means is of course, debatable, right?
You're saying specifically that the government accepts the burden asserted by the defendant, that the government had an obligation to show an intention to, let's get the language exact, to obstruct the lawful exercise of parental rights.
Yes. Okay. The government has a burden to prove that when the defendant took the child out of the country, that he did so with the intent to obstruct the parental rights of the mother in this case.
But your your further submission is that that can be proved by showing that he knew the natural and probable consequence of taking him out of the country.
Not only
he may not have wanted to obstruct, but he knew that was the consequence, right?
Well, I think the evidence here is that he knew.
Let's forget about the evidence. Let's try to get the law right. What is the government's position on the law?
That is to say,
nature of the government's burden under this statute.
The government can prove through circumstantial evidence, and that includes through the natural and probable consequences of one's knowing acts.
Right. So you're saying that if he knows that there is a court order, which there is, he knows that his wife does not agree to the kid being taken out, that there's no writing, and he then takes the kid out, a jury can conclude that he intended to obstruct. It's not that he doesn't have to show intent. It's not that he doesn't have to show that he wanted to obstruct. It's that that is sufficient evidence under the sufficiency prong of this question here to prove the intent that's required.
That's right. And
we seem now to be back, if that's right, we seem to be back to proof of an intention to do acts which have the natural and probable consequence of obstructing parental rights, which I'd sort of assumed was the government's position before, but we seem to have been around a lot of different places.
If I'm understanding your question correctly, the government believes that the instruction was proper, that the jury could infer that the defendant acted, that he intended the natural and probable consequences of his acts knowingly done or omitted, and that from that would have been sufficient for a jury to find the defendant guilty under the statute.
So it doesn't require a purpose to obstruct the lawful exercise of parental rights.
I think it does, but I think that by examining the
You don't want to say
point.
That because the word purpose, at least in the model penal code, has a much different meaning. And if you look at Gypsum and all the cases on this mens rea question, so I don't think you want to be careful about the word purpose.
I think the language of the instruction properly allows a jury to find specific intent based on the natural and probable consequences of the acts knowingly done. And here, there was more than sufficient evidence for a jury to find not only from the natural and probable consequences of the acts knowingly done that he acted with specific intent, but that he purposefully and intentionally deceived Ms. Hernandez to prevent her from exercising her rights and saying, no, I don't want this child taken out of the country. He not only lied to her about where he was taking the child, he sold his business for cash without even telling her. He later admitted to the FBI agent that, yeah, he didn't ask her for consent because he knew she wouldn't give it. In doing all of these acts, he took from her opportunity to say, no, I don't care.
Yeah, I think you've made an overwhelming case that the natural and probable consequences of his acts, which were knowable in advance, involved the the obstruction of parental rights. But at least I don't think you've shown the purpose at all.
Well, in other statutes, such as the Mann Act, that's been interpreted with the similar statutory language of with intent, I would point out the case of United States versus Julian that the government has cited in its brief. In that case, the defendant facilitated the interstate transportation of a victim from Mexico into the United States for the purposes of prostitution. The judgment was affirmed in that case, where the jury was instructed, where the finding in that case was supported by evidence that although the defendant may not specifically, with the sole and exclusive intent, acted to bring that victim from Mexico for the purposes of prostitution, he knew that he acted as a prostitute in Mexico and that the likelihood of him continuing to act as such in Los Angeles, given the other individuals that they had in common, that he specifically acted with that intent necessary under the statute. And the government would argue that's analogous here. The natural and probable consequences is facilitating that victim's transportation was that he would continue to act in prostitution in the United States, and that by facilitating his transportation across the border, that he acted with intent to facilitate that transportation for the purposes of engaging in prostitution.
On the 2255, given that we're very unusual in entertaining these on direct appeal, what's your response to the suggestion that we should exercise that power narrowly so as to not unduly foreclose a defendant's right to raise an ineffective assistance claim in the district court in the first instance?
Well, I think that the assertions that are made by defense counsel of all the different things that trial counsel should have done below, even if you take all of those things as true, the government does not believe that there is any reasonable probability whatsoever that the outcome would have been different below, even if you take all of those assertions and assume that trial counsel had done those things, or assuming that an evidentiary hearing below would just show the things that have been asserted on appeal. The government believes that the outcome would have remained the same because of the evidence that we put forward at trial on the record before this court of
assuming
specific intent.
Assuming the instruction was correct, the evidence is so overwhelming there couldn't have been a different result.
That's right, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, the government would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Thank you. How much time does Ms. Rowland have? I'll give you another minute or two.
I'd like to make 2 points. One is that on the interpretation of the statute, we disagree that obstructing Ms. Hernandez's ability to stop him is the same as obstructing her parental rights. He deceived her by saying that he was taking the child to King's Dominion, but that sort of the deception was obstructing her ability to stop him, to interfere with him taking the child. But that interfering with obstructing her ability to stop him from doing what he wanted to do is not the same as obstructing her parental rights.
Custody agreement said what? That the child couldn't be taken out of the country without written permission? Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And imagine, and he did take the kid out without written permission, right?
Yes.
And he knew he didn't have written permission?
Yes.
And take for purposes of this question that he knew she would not give written permission. Why isn't that enough? If his intention is to take the child out of the country without her written permission, knowing that she wouldn't give written permission, why doesn't that obstruct her lawful exercise of parental rights? Her parental rights are to keep the kid in the country with her.
Well, her parental rights are to have physical custody of the child.
Right. And he took her out of the country. He intended to take her away, him, away from the country. Why isn't that?
And my only point is that the government argued today specifically that obstructing her ability to say no is a violation of the statute. And I think that there's a distinction between, deceiving her so that she wouldn't know he was getting on a plane and having the intent to obstruct her parental rights. The obstructing the parental rights is taking the child out of the country.
Right.
Obstructing her ability to say, halt, you can't do this.
Right, the parental rights is the right to have the kid with her in the country.
Right. So I disagree with the government's statement that obstructing her ability to say no is a violation of the statute.
That makes it even harder for you, though, doesn't it? I mean, it's not obstructing her ability to say no. It's just taking the kid out of the country without her written permission.
No. That would be if it was a general intent crime. It has to be
intending to do that.
Intending to obstruct her parental rights.
Right. What,
yes.
What do you think? What evidence would be overwhelming on this subject, other than either a MRI in which you could read inside the mind with a little thought balloon, or he writes a diary in which said, "I specifically intend." Other than that, What's powerful evidence? Or do you think people just can't be convicted of this crime?
Perhaps evidence that, he said to other people, you know, obviously you can't get in his head, but that he said to other people or that he wrote, you know, I think that she shouldn't have custody. She's a terrible mother. In fact, there's evidence the opposite, that he always said, you're a wonderful mother.
But you don't think you have to have direct, you agree you could have circumstantial.
Yes, absolutely. And here, I wanted to make one more point as to the ineffective assistance claim. Defense counsel's job was to create a reasonable doubt in the jury's mind, and the government had some amount of evidence, perhaps sufficient, perhaps not, that he intended to obstruct her parental rights. And his job was to mount a defense here, to create a reasonable doubt in the jury's mind. And the things that, the 13 or 12 things that we've listed in our brief are things that we think would have built a mountain high enough to create that reasonable doubt.
Yes. Did you argue in your brief that there's something wrong with the instruction? I didn't catch it. The other judges apparently did, and I'm just not sure where that was.
I made arguments about the definition of a specific intent crime and that we think this is
intent crime. Did you say anything about the instruction being wrong, didn't you? Or did you? I don't recall.
It's
you don't recall
my recollection that I did. Okay. I'm wishing that I had.
don't feel bad about it.
Your purpose.
Maybe we'll have another ineffective assistance.
Don't worry about it.
Counsel. Thank you.
Both sides did very well. I don't think we'll have that problem. Thank you.